Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy rants and raves from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to tinker and innovate. I'm Evan Schwartzschrauber, your host. On today's show, 20 years of internet regulation. It's been 20 years since Congress passed the 1996 Telecom Act, and that was the first major update to our nation's communications law since 1934. Since then, no major update. So today we're going to talk about what it got right and what it got wrong. Joining me in our DC studio to discuss this is Awkward Dinner guest and president of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka. Baron, welcome back to the show.
You know, most people find me a charming dinner guest.
Well, Baron, you've been away from the show for a while now, and we've never had more subscribers. So is this a coincidence?
Probably not.
Well, we'll give it a try. We'll do some A-B testing today, see if people like you again. So Web 2.0, user-generated content, things like Facebook and Twitter, these are things that today we can take for granted because we've had them for so long. But if our law in 1996 went a different way, we might never have seen these things succeed, or they might have been managed much differently. So this is an example where the act might have gotten something right. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's what Adam Thier calls a negative law. Section 230 of the Telecommunications Act is probably the most important part of that law. It basically said that online platforms wouldn't be treated the way that newspapers were under traditional tort law. If you're a newspaper and you publish a letter to the editor, you're liable for that if it's defamatory. And so that liability is something that would have crushed online speech platforms simply for the reason of scale. There's no way that you could screen the literally billions of photos and comments and videos that are posted online. So if Congress hadn't intervened, hadn't said that Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and all those other sites wouldn't be liable for that content, they would never have existed. We'd probably still be using something like AOL today.
And the only person I know that still has an AOL account is my 59-year-old uncle. So we wouldn't want to see that world. But it's crazy to think, you know, listeners use Facebook and Twitter. It's kind of a, you know, Wild West. People can put whatever they want on there. I mean, can you imagine if Facebook had to be liable for everything that got posted on its platform? It never could have existed. I mean, what do you think these companies just wouldn't have come into existence?
Well, they might have existed, but they look very different. They wouldn't be the open platforms that we have today. They'd be a lot more controlled. You'd have to have filtering, and you may not be able to share as much user-generated content. It's pretty clear that the internet as we know it today wouldn't exist. It would be very different and, frankly, a lot less innovative, a lot less creative, and a lot less open if it hadn't been for Section 230.
And Section 230 did something good. It allowed these platforms to exist, but it's the act didn't get censorship right in all aspects. So what aspects of censorship did the act kind of screw up?
Well, indeed, Section 230 was really supposed to be a way of softening the act's generally heavy-handed approach to censorship. So what the act actually did was to require the FCC to censor online indecency, and specifically to require age verification for anyone accessing indecent content. And that's not just obscene content, not just pornography, but anything that fit into that definition that might have talked about bodily functions and sexual health and so on. And that was a crazy idea, but it was one that was very supported at the time. There was a panic about technology in the mid-1990s. And the Supreme Court, fortunately, spared us from that, and said that that would have violated the First Amendment because it would have required age verification of all users, at least for accessing potentially objectionable content, in order to pick out the ones who are actually under 18.
Yeah, we've talked about how age verification, if it's not done smartly, can really just stymie the development of a platform because it screws with the ability of that platform to manage their content appropriately. If they can't, If people are going to lie about their age to get access, then Facebook can't make sure that someone who's under 18 has an appropriate viewing experience.
Yeah, that's the really perverse result. And Congress recognized that sort of thing. Section 230 wasn't just about letting the internet be a Wild West. It was about creating an incentive or removing a disincentive for companies to be good Samaritans, to create environments that are appropriate for kids. And you can't do that if you create an artificial incentive for kids to lie. Now, unfortunately, the FCC is still in the censorship business. The 96 Act didn't change the fact that the FCC is still trying to censor broadcast speech.
Right.
Here we are, you know, 80 years after the original Act, and we're still basically fighting the same fights, even though the tools available today for parents because of Section 230, because there was no disincentive to build those tools. Those tools would previously have made you more liable for offensive speech. Those tools now allow parents to decide what their kids can do on the internet, on video game platforms, and watching their television set.
Yeah, parental controls have never been easier and more available. Another area that the 96 Act dealt with was competition. And today's FCC often gripes about what they perceive as a lack of broadband competition, and you've said in the past that they're just willfully ignoring good news, and we'll have more on that Thursday when we have FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai on the show. But since 1996, we've had over $1.3 trillion in broadband investment. So does Congress deserve some credit here for that act?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other big legacy of the 96 Act, apart from Section 230, was essentially legalizing broadband competition. So even before broadband meant what it meant today, broadband originally meant having a thick pipe that you could use to deliver video traffic. So the telephone network was not a broadband network. It could only carry voice traffic.
Right.
And back in the day, before the 96 Act, the only game in town for broadband, for delivering video, was the cable network. Satellite came along, and that could deliver a very powerful video, and Congress had tried to encourage satellite to take off as an alternative to video. But the most important thing the 96 Act did was to promote another pipe to the home that could carry not only video content, but internet traffic. And that's what the telephone companies were able to start building as an alternative to cable modem, because the 1996 Act, for the first time, made it legal for telephone companies to deliver video service themselves.
So before that, you're basically, competition was illegal. And I mean, this agency is always looking for ways to promote competition, and often that's not what it's doing.
Yeah, and it's not just that. It's that the agency is stuck in the paradigm of its time. So in 96, when Congress thought about broadband, it was thinking about video. It wasn't thinking about the internet.
Right.
John Podesta, who was chief of staff for President Clinton, really nailed this after the act was passed. He said that basically Congress had regulated as if the internet didn't exist. Now, it turns out that it was very fortunate that Congress made this move to legalize video competition, because that eventually made it possible for us to have, unlike many European countries, two competing pipes to the home. And that's something that today you can complain about there not being enough broadband competition, but two is infinitely better than one.
So whenever we see something good in this law, there's usually at least one or two things that were bad about it in the same realm. So let's talk about competition. You say that they legalized video competition, which was great, but the law was also short-sighted in that it really had this myopic focus on engineering competition for telephone service, and you might say that it's artificial competition. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, just as the act essentially assumed that video competition was going to come primarily from satellite and then maybe from telephone companies, it assumed that there really wasn't going to be effective competition for telephone service because that was a monopoly, and that the only way to get competition was to create these so-called competitive resellers, who were really government-created crony capitalist companies that would just resell the monopoly telephone network at rates that were set by the government. So that was called unbundling of network elements. The idea, it's a kind of infrastructure socialism. That sort of thing is really only ever appropriate when you're never going to get a true facilities-based competition, because once you start down that road, you create an enormous disincentive to build competing networks. So in other words, you can either have fake competition with a monopoly network, or you can try to promote competition among competing networks using different facilities and investing in them. You can't have it both ways. And the act really didn't get this right. The FCC then spent 9 years trying to figure out how to invent competition. Meanwhile, while it was dicking around with so-called competitive resellers, actual competition emerged in the marketplace because cable companies started to offer VoIP service for telephony. A lot of people switched to wireless service. So today, the idea that you get your wireless or your telephone service from your, quote, telephone company is crazy. I mean, most people don't do that. Competition has taken off despite the FCC. And in the 10 years that they spent on that, they didn't do the things the act had told them to do. Like, number one, stop municipalities from strangling new entry. In theory, the act did that. It said you can no longer deny a franchise to a new video entrant, but in practice, that didn't really change until about 2006. And even then, even today, Google Fiber, for example, as it tries to build a third pipe to the home, is revealing that, local governments still make deployment very difficult.
So the key distinction here is you have two different types of competition. You have facilities-based competition. That's getting more pipes to the home, which is more networks. And that will usually lead to better outcomes for consumers, whereas the FCC had this focus on just reselling the one monopoly provider, which isn't very innovative. You have the same one pipe, and then you're just redoing it over and over again with different rates. And that's not necessarily going to lead to any innovation. And you argue that it actually is going to crowd out other pipes.
Yeah, the data on this is pretty clear. The U.S. has twice the investment per capita as in Europe. Most European countries still have essentially a monopoly network. When you look at counts of number of competitors, what you're usually seeing is these artificial resellers. There are many countries around the world that have doubled down on that unbundling model. And what they've gotten is a perpetuation of the underlying monopoly. Whereas in the U.S., we now have most people have access to two providers, and many are getting access to a third. And that's really what the FCC should be focusing on instead of this artificial competition. I always like to use the example of Verizon Fios. That system would not have been possible if the FCC had not said back in 2003 that it was not going to extend unbundling mandates to new fiber systems. If the FCC had not clarified the regulatory treatment of the telephone companies' networks, and if the FCC had not eventually cracked down on localities to essentially force them to allow Verizon to deploy. It's still too hard for other companies to deploy. Google Fiber has a lot of problems. That's something that I hope to be part of a new COM Act update. But generally speaking, the agency and the act eventually got it right. It just took them way too long.
Yeah, and let's talk about how unbundling has reared its ugly head in a recent development where the FCC is mandating that video providers, whether it's a cable company or a telephone company, now have to change the nature of their equipment to allow anyone to have a third-party cable box. So yeah, they did it with telephone service. They avoided the unbundling with broadband, and that's why we see twice the investment per capita as Europe. But here we are in 2016. We just talked about all the problems with unbundling, and they're going right blindly into this new area. And it sounds good in theory, right? So the FCC says people are sick of renting cable boxes. It costs X amount of money per year, and they willfully ignore that one of the reasons your cable box price might increase is because you're getting way more content than you did 20 years ago. There's a lot more channels. But why is something that sounds so good in theory that's going to help consumers, like having more options for a cable box, what's the problem there?
Well, in each of these cases, the FCC is fighting yesterday's war. And they're assuming that there's a monopoly and that the only way to force that open is with a regulatory mandate. Whereas what they really should be focusing on is competition. I mean, if Google Fiber had an easier time deploying, if Verizon and AT&T had an easier time upgrading their networks to compete with cable, this wouldn't be an issue. I mean, we could safely rely on market forces to deal with this, as I think we actually can. In other words, what I'm saying is we have a lot more competition today than the FCC recognizes, and we'd have even more of it if the FCC had focused on what should have been its number one goal. And let's not forget that back in 2010, the FCC produced this enormous report about broadband in America that was supposed to be about competition and essentially did almost nothing with that. There is still a host of problems that the FCC isn't focused on because they keep operating in this old mentality of there's essentially only one network, and then grudgingly maybe they'll acknowledge there's a second, but they refuse to acknowledge how fundamentally different those are, or that there could be a third or more networks.
And oftentimes the FCC fights these battles over the old technology, and by the time they finish litigating it, we'll be looking back and laughing that we've ever had the argument in the first place. I mean, it's not crazy to think that cable boxes are dying out. I mean, the future of TV is apps. People are going to be watching TV on an app, so why do we care so much about this piece of hardware that no one's going to have anyway? So we've talked about censorship, what it got right, what it got wrong. We talked about competition. Now let's talk about regulation. With the notable exception of the unbundling mandates, which we just talked about, the 1996 Telecom Act was broadly an act of deregulation. And the general thrust, Congress could not have been more clear. Quote, "It is the policy of the United States to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the internet and other interactive computer services unfettered by federal or state regulation." And of course, they also had the ongoing review to deregulate. They could keep deregulating after 96 and find new ways to remove red tape. So, Barron, what's their report card? I mean, have they been doing a good job of deregulating?
Well, yes and no. It's totally up to them. I mean, the problem here with the act is that it gives them the discretion to make those decisions. So at times, they have done a very good job. The Clinton administration really set in motion a move away from Title II. Bill Kennard was Bill Clinton's FCC chairman. He saw very quickly how obsolete the 96 Act was. Even by 1999, he was calling for essentially moving beyond regulatory silos. And he warned that moving towards Title II, continuing to impose that on broadband pipelines, would really thwart new deployment. And he warned that that would really hurt the most marginal in America most. It's not an accident that he was the first African-American chairman of the FCC, and that his concern was really about people on the margins and investment on the margins.
Just to bring people up to speed, Title II of the 1934 Communications Act, that's regulations designed for the old telephone monopoly. And whereas the Clinton administration specifically avoided that classification for the internet, this FCC just recently put the internet in that bucket in a drastic change from 20 years of bipartisan consensus.
Yeah, and just to take a big step back, remember the original 1934 Act had essentially two silos. You had the telephone network in Title II, and you had wireless in Title III. Congress eventually came along and added a new silo for cable. And then in 1996, Congress realized that there were these other things out there, the internet, whatever that was going to be, didn't really know what to do with them, and so put them into Title I. But it wasn't exactly clear in how it drew those lines. And so Bill Kennard had to start figuring out, well, what do we do with broadband? Where should it go?
Yeah.
And essentially, I think it's pretty clear that he was about to do what Michael Powell, the first Bush chairman, the second African-American chairman of the agency, did, which was to say that cable modem was not a Title II service and that the telephone services were not Title II services. For the same basic reason in both cases, both Democrats and Republicans understood that Title II was a self-fulfilling prophecy. It presumed that you were going to have a monopoly network, and it tended to keep it that way. And he tried to move away from that. Unfortunately, we then got into this long debate about how to regulate net neutrality, which is really a very separate issue. But after losing in court twice on this, instead of using narrower grounds, the FCC, after the president intervened, decided that it was going to use Title II, thus turning on its head this bipartisan consensus you had, and really calling into question the fundamental thing the 96 Act got right, which was trying to promote competition by avoiding regulation that stifles investment in new networks.
Yeah, and I just mentioned the FCC's move with the set-top boxes, and part of the point there is that we're moving away from these old school technologies, and maybe having these silos in the first place doesn't make sense, because the more that this technology advances and now we're watching TV over the internet and we're using apps instead of cable boxes, does it make sense to have different regulations for broadcast, different regulations for video, different regulations for internet, if that's all going to be blended together in the very near future?
Yeah, of course not. And the FCC recognizes that. Pretty much everyone recognizes that. The question is what you do about it. The FCC is essentially already dealing with that problem by inventing a new act out of thin air. Right. That's really what the Open Internet Order that just turned 1 year old last week did. The FCC essentially said, not only are we going to regulate net neutrality, but we're going to use these broad powers we've claimed under Title II and under other sections of the act to create a new technologically neutral approach to internet regulation. And in a way, they're right that they need a technologically neutral approach. The problem is they're doing this in the most undemocratic, untransparent way possible. And the way that they're writing rules maximizes the amount of discretion that they have, so that they'll keep things vague. Their decision-making will be fundamentally political. No one will really know. And it will create massive uncertainty about how the internet's going to be regulated in the future that, quite frankly, will change from election to election. That's not a recipe for long-term investment, for encouraging competition, or for taking the politics out of internet regulation.
So the FCC and you agree on one thing, that we need new communications law. The issue is they're going about it by just reinventing the old law or claiming new powers of authority or new powers and authorities without getting anything new from Congress. And the COM Act update, this is something that we talk about. You know, it's a hashtag on Twitter if you want to check it out, with two COM Act update with two M's. Clearly, 1996 until now, there's been just dramatic changes, dramatic innovation. And the fact that our communications law hasn't been updated is just crazy. But unfortunately, it's looking like this year there's not the political will for a COM Act update. But to conclude our, you know, our show, let's talk about what that should look like, assuming that we get a, maybe a president that's willing to put some political capital into this. In your mind, what does a COM Act update need to do to bring our communications law into the 21st century? Because it's already been 16 years and it needs to happen.
Yeah, well, let's start with what we started with today, censorship. So number one, I would say stop the censorship. Let parents decide for themselves. Technological empowerment really has fundamentally changed the world, and the FCC needs to recognize that. So it's time for the FCC to get out of that business. Number two, competition should be the FCC's number one focus. Stop fighting yesterday's battles about monopoly and focus on making competition easier. The FCC's only way of doing that, when they talk about competition, what they're really talking about is government-run networks. They say they want competition, but they really want taxpayers to subsidize new networks that are built at the state and local level with huge subsidies. There might be a time and place for that. There might be some areas of the country where that's the only way you're going to get competition, but I think that's pretty rare. And for the most part, I think the much better approach to this is learn from Google Fiber's experience. Make deployment easier, cut the red tape, lower fees, and if you're going to invest taxpayer dollars in something, do it in making deployment cheaper. So that thing you talked about earlier about unbundling, I actually think there is a very positive version of unbundling here, which is not the networks that we want people to invest in, because that's where you create that disincentive. It's the underlying dumb tube. It's literally the tube under the street. It might be the poles that you hang your fiber on. Those are largely public assets, and those should be available to anyone. So that I would very much encourage localities to invest in, but that's very different from having them build their own networks, which involves all the hardware and the upgrades and the maintenance and, frankly, the control over who says what.
And as the net neutrality fight last year demonstrated, one of the biggest issues about or concerning the FCC these days is its discretion, right? A lot of these battles, it's not even necessarily a battle about whether the regulation is correct or a good idea. It's like, do they have this authority in the first place? So if the FCC claims so much authority that it could basically rewrite the Telecom Act of 96, that means that the COM Act update is going to need to address their authority. What authority do they have going forward? What does a 21st century FCC look like in a world where technology is constantly changing and government has not shown an ability to keep up? So what needs to be done about their discretion?
Yeah, so I always distinguish between authority and discretion. I don't necessarily have a problem with the FCC having broad authority in terms of having, let's say, jurisdiction over all forms of communications. My problem is with the agency's discretion. You can't have it both ways, right? Because then you get into completely unconstrained regulation. What you really need to do, sure, let them have broad authority, make it technologically neutral, but require that they justify what they're doing and actually ground it in some analysis of what's good for consumers. I mean, the problem today is the agency is really stuck in a kind of groundhog day of overregulation. They're constantly overdoing it, and they never really have to learn from their mistakes. They never have to justify themselves. When they're challenged in court, it's basically on legalistic and process grounds. It's never on substance, mm-hmm. right? That's fundamentally different from how we regulate every other market in America, where antitrust, consumer protection laws are ultimately grounded in an analysis of what's good for consumers. So by all means, give the agency broad authority, but constrain its discretion and really help it focus on serving consumers well. That should be the fundamental point of rewriting the act.
And that's one way of doing it. But you have conservatives who are very upset about the FCC's perceived overreach and the net neutrality fight. And you'll see people saying things like abolish the FCC or at least fundamentally rethink its core functions. So is there something to that? I mean, even people like Larry Lessig, who we disagree with on net neutrality, have said in the past that the FCC might need to go. Who would police the internet if the FCC were gone?
Yeah, well, Alfred Kahn, who deregulated the airlines for Jimmy Carter, the great deregulator, it wasn't Ronald Reagan, he always said his greatest regret was that he couldn't have been FCC chairman because he would have dismantled the agency.
Well, that's a hell of a first day in that office.
Yeah, well, he was right. And the point here is the FCC is never going to be abolished, and talking about abolishing it is frankly crazy. But I think it could and should be dismantled. And the difference is key. You could break up its functions. You transfer the consumer protection, competition policing functions to the Federal Trade Commission. They've got broad expertise here. The FCC has expertise in these markets. You should combine them. You can make a powerful but thoughtful regulator that could really focus on real problems without trying to design new technologies. And you transfer the spectrum management functions to the Department of Commerce. That's definitely the best way to go. But the second best solution would just be to make the FCC work more like the Federal Trade Commission, more grounded in thoughtful analysis of what is really wrong with markets. Because if you don't do that, the agency really ends up trying to design tomorrow's markets for yesterday's challenges. And it will consistently underestimate the damage that it does and the way that it discourages competition, even when it's talking about competition.
And since most of what we talked about today concerns the FCC and the FCC is going to be involved, unfortunately, we're really not going to see movement on this until after the election, because the future of the internet will be very different under a Clinton FCC or a Rubio FCC, or the visions are very different. So listeners, probably not going to see much movement on Comact Update this year, but when you see another president, they might really make a big deal out of this and decide to use political capital to rewrite our communications law, which is woefully out of date.
Well, let's flash back to 1993. Clinton and Gore understood these problems of the act being obsolete before it was written. They wanted a technologically neutral act, and if you dust off what they said at the time, it still makes sense today. The problem is they didn't really invest the political capital into getting that part right, and so the act really became obsolete very quickly. My concern is that if a new president doesn't invest in this issue, doesn't make it a priority at the beginning of his or her administration, we're not going to see a new act written. It could be many years before we do. Or if it is written, it's not going to fix the fundamental problems. It'll be just another kind of jerry-rigging of the old act. And we'll be having this conversation again and really the very next day without really solving the fundamental issue.
Well, that's it for today's show. For more on this topic, check out our website, techfreedom.org, where we have a blog post about the anniversary of the Telecom Act, what it got right, what it got wrong. Follow the discussion on Twitter. A lot of people in the telecom world are tweeting about this today with the hashtag 20 years ago. That's 20 YRS ago. Find us on Twitter at TechFreedom. Find us on Facebook at TechFreedom. And find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will really help us out. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit, tax-exempt think tank based in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work in tech policy and for more episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.